I'm talking with Andy Zaltzman today, and I'm going to try to keep my fanboying to a minimum, but it must be said that I think The Bugle is the most seminal creation in the annals of journalism and political satire ever.
I'll quote you on that.
Yes, you may quote me, if I can use seminal and annals in the same sentence.
As long as you spell it right.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or tablet or phone. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast number 509, The Bugle Podcast. I wasn't kidding. The Bugle Podcast is one of the great creations in audio entertainment, a weekly dose of satire that brings sanity to a frequently insane political world. Co-created and co-hosted by British comedians Andy Zaltzman and John Oliver, it is appointment listening in our house because week after week, Andy and John turn that week's news events into fantastic and pointed political comedy. Now that John Oliver has taken his talents to HBO, The Bugle's format and frequency has changed in the last year, which is why it was all the more exciting for me to meet and chat with Andy Zaltzman last month when I was in Edinburgh. Andy was gracious enough to meet me before a performance of his stand-up show Plan Z and talk about how The Bugle started and how it was created week after week and what form it's likely to take in the future.
I'm so thrilled to get a chance to talk to you about how it started, because clearly you're the brains of the Bugle outfit, am I right?
Oh, definitely, yeah. So, well, it started late in 2007. I'd had a double act with John Oliver.
I'm sorry, who?
I forget some British guy who's
right.
Busking in New York at the moment. So we did a live double act for a while. We did lots of radio series together. We sort of worked together. For 5 years, as well as doing our own individual stuff.
Right.
And then he got the Daily Show job, and that came up a couple of weeks before we were due to come and do a two-handed show at the Edinburgh Festival here, just across the road from where we're sitting now in Stand One. And for some reason, rather than playing to 30 people in Stand One a night, he decided to go and take the job on the world's leading satirical comedy show. So baffles me to this day.
How ambitiously American of him.
Well, exactly. Very un-British. So I ended up doing the show on my own. And then we didn't really work together for, well, over a year. And then our managers had done podcasts with the Times newspapers online arm. With other people, and they managed to get us a deal to do a topical podcast, and we called it The Bugle, and we had a 13-week deal to start with, and it just sort of went from there. So when we recorded the pilot, it was sort of the first time that we'd performed together in about 15 months, I think, since John went to the States, maybe even longer, and it seemed to work.
Uh-huh. And were you in the same room at that point?
No, we were. John was in New York, and so it was down an ISDN line, and I was in a studio in London.
Yeah.
And, it seemed to work, and so it just sort of gradually built up from there.
There's so many things I love about it, not least of which is the intelligence behind it, or the appearance of intelligence behind it. But the fact that also you two, as a double act, seem to delight in making each other laugh, and when you're not doing puns and John is agonizing. How much of that is a surprise week to week?
Well, it sort of happened almost accidentally to start with. I think we thought we'd sort of write together, and then just the logistics of being on different continents with an ocean between us meant that it was easier if we just wrote separately. And so we discussed the stories we would do, write separately. So when we then recorded, we didn't know what the other person was going to say. So it's so then became the challenge to try and, I guess, surprise the person on the other end of the line and try and make them laugh. And And hopefully most of the laughter's genuine, I think.
So, it certainly seemed genuine. It always seems genuine. Although, does John really hate puns as much as he claims to, or appears to?
Well, I mean, he says that, but then they do crop up quite often in his own work on television. He doesn't seem to be able to stand them in a podcast, but he's happy to do them on telly. I mean, that's double standard.
Methinks the lad does protest too much. Well, indeed. And how much... I mean, you... I mean, I finally got to see your live comedy act yesterday, and because we our shows conflict, and it was the only day I could see. It was on my day off, and it is so verbal. There is so much verbiage coming at you, and I think there's a lot of verbiage coming out of your head. I mean, there's a lot of text, words. I'm just saying words, quantities, and that's a lot to come up with every week. Was that difficult, or is that just a thing? It just falls out of you.
Well, a lot of verbiage. I'm not putting that on my next poster. That is it. Anyway,
in the greatest possible complimentary sense.
I don't know. I guess the Bugle was great because it gave us a deadline.
Yeah.
And without deadlines, in my life, things tend to drift. So it was great having that discipline of having to write a lot of stuff on different stories, and you know, try and maintain the standards that we tried to set. It became, I guess the focal point of my my week, and I think because we had quite a small amount of time to write it in, when you know, we sort of discussed the stories a day or two before, and then when we could, I found myself writing in quite an improvisational way almost, and a lot of it is kind of first draft. It's the first thoughts, and just whack them out on paper. Sometimes even in bullet point form, sometimes word for word, and so that became sort of the way that I wrote. It's almost going on your first instincts.
Right.
And so it's, I guess, you know, it's a couple of steps away from full improv, but it's almost writing in that, an instinctive, trained instinct, which I guess is what a lot of improv is.
And then you follow, you yes and each other, then on the recording day, right? Because it feels like you kind of play off of each other. But then how much of it is like, oh, you know what? I thought of a way to say that better. Do you go back? Does it take 3 hours to record a half an hour?
Oh, no. The recording was generally an hour, a bit longer in the early days at the time, so we had a bit more studio time.
When Chris and everybody were kicking you out of the studio.
Yeah, that's right. So it tends to be recorded in an hour, and so it's basically we put out most of what we record. In stand-up, I mean, a lot of the stand-up show is, you know, some of it's brand new, some of it's adapted from ideas on the Bugle that we'd look at again and try and develop a bit more, and then, you know, just the natural process of stand-up evolving through performance, finding the different laughter points, finding different ways of getting to them. With the verbiage.
Well, one of the things I loved about your show is that your asides are funnier than many people's punchlines.
Oh, thank you. my punchlines are awful.
But please, asides are terrific.
I guess that was something that we tried to do in our live stuff, and certainly our radio stuff before John went to America, where we packed the script as much as possible, tried to make every line work. And I was thinking, you know, there's just little almost sub-jokes you can put in stand-up that aren't necessarily intended to make people laugh, but they add to the general comedic aura of a show.
Yeah.
So you're always trying to make sure that every line is working to some comic purpose.
And is that how stand-up works as well? And do you script and memorize your stand-up, or do you bullet point it and just start testing it out and see what works?
A bit of both, actually. I mean, I used to sort of sit down and write it word for word, but I found more recently, which I think probably most stand-ups do, you'll go on ideas and you'll do them at shows, and then the phrasing almost emerges gradually from trial and error. quite a lot of error in some cases and some gigs. But
you talk memorably on the Bugle about disastrous gigs.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's been plenty of them. So,
but yesterday's gig seemed phenomenal. Was that because we're late in the run and you've got it honed, or was it pretty good from the top, from the beginning?
I think it took a few days to bed in. A lot of it was pretty new stuff. Obviously, there's been some fairly significant political events in this country this summer. So, trying to do material about that. And, I haven't done that much stand-up through this year, so a lot of it is sort of getting back into gear with that. And I like to keep working on a show through the whole month in Edinburgh, because I think there's a danger that if you stick on something, it can get a little stale. So I try to put in new jokes, or just slightly tweak the wording of something all the way through to try and keep it fresh.
And do you feel like you have to get up on stage every so often? You know, you've got to. Is it like working out, like working a muscle, getting up and doing jokes in front of a crowd?
I don't know if it's like working a muscle. It's more an addiction, I think, once you've right. done it. And after, you know, if you go a while without doing gigs, you start to think I should be doing more. But that said, I don't like to do too much.
Right.
I mean, some comedians will gig almost every night of the year, but I like to see my family and do other stuff as well.
How very old school.
Yeah.
And this is your, you said you've been coming to the Edinburgh Fringe a lot. Has the Fringe been great for you as a great... I guess that's the question. What does the Fringe do for you, aside from being a great showcase?
Well, I guess it's all through my career. I did my first solo show in 2001 when I'd only been doing stand-up sort of 2.5 years, roughly. But it's always been, I guess, the place that I've come to try stuff out, to try and get better, to improve. And it's an amazing phenomenon that there's this one city for a month when there are just thousands and thousands of people going to comedy shows. Yeah. So yeah. Even if, you know, you don't have a massive profile, you can get a decent number of people to come and see you over the course of a month. So you can develop both an individual show and just your general comedic skills. And then there's an element that you're seeing other comedians, you're sort of seeing everyone's ideas bubbling up together. So it's always been quite inspirational as a place to come to as a comedian.
And and you're part of a community of comedians. I've heard you guys play football together.
Yes. I'm glad you did not call it soccer.
No,
its correct name.
Do you?
I've learned something from the Bugle over the years.
Right. You are on this side of the Atlantic, you will call it football. We have a game in London every Tuesday that John used to play on before he got his big transfer to the New York Red Bulls. And it's quite nice and social, and everyone sort of forgets about their career strife and just plays football.
Hi, this is Simon Helberg, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? This week, our fall of 2016 tour of the special election edition of The Complete History of America Abridged continues as we take it to more than 17 states, including Missouri, Iowa, Montana, Indiana, Minnesota, Utah, Michigan, Kentucky, Alaska, Washington, New Jersey, Ohio, Virginia, South Carolina, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Florida. We'll also be touring for 3 weeks in China, and in February 2017, we'll begin our four-month UK tour of William Shakespeare's long-lost first play, Abridged. We'll have more information about all of our overseas tours later this fall. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office, venue, and ticket information. And now back to my conversation with Andy Zaltzman, the co-creator of the Bugle Podcast, the definitive audio newspaper for a visual world. One of the things that we find in our shows, because our shows have a collection of puns, generally, typically. And sometimes we'll get audiences who just feel like it's their obligation to groan at every pun, which, in their defense, and this will be the last time I defend them, I think they think that's what they're supposed to do at a pun. Do you agree? Can you defend the pun for me as a master of the form?
Well, yeah, the groan, I don't know, it's like a Pavlovian reflex, isn't it, the groan?
Yes, it is.
I've been trained to groan at puns.
Yeah.
I'm an admirer of the pun, as you would know if you listened to the Bugle. I like to do them not all the time, but when I do go in for them, I go in pretty hard with a barrage of many.
Go big or go home, as we say.
That's exactly. It's a very American attitude towards it. everything to excess, and I've not done so much in stand-up. My last couple of shows in Edinburgh, I've had a little outbreak of of puns, but they get an interesting reaction live sometimes. But then, there's some comedians. Right, we have Tim Vine over here. I don't know if you're aware of his work. Who's the unquestioned Nebuchadnezzar of pun work? And his shows they develop this incredible momentum of hilarity. People sort of realise, this is it, and he's glorious. He's one of my favourite comedians to watch.
But you do, maybe there weren't as many puns yesterday, but you do love also and I say this again complimentarily, a tortured simile.
Yes. Well, the more tortured, the better often. I like to waterboard my similes before they finally give up their joke. And, yes, I mean, I think obviously it's a commonly used comedic tool, the simile, and it has been for thousands of years. And I studied ancient Greek comedy at university, which was fascinating. And, you know, so I can say I'm applying my degree to my sceptical parents. I think so. There's an interest in creating a simile that creates an image, almost a little world of its own, and yet is sort of valid for the satirical point you're making or the thing you're comparing it to.
Absolutely. If you're going to tell, was it Mark Twain or Will Rogers? If you're going to tell people the truth, better make them laugh, or they'll hurt you.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, we're talking about ancient Greek comedy. Aristophanes wrote these comic plays to be performed in front of the entire male population of ancient Athens. He said something almost exactly the same, albeit in Greek. And Reginald D. Hunter, an American comedian who works mostly over here, said another thing. This is common through the history of comedy, that it is a great vehicle for telling the truth or your version of the truth in a sort of indirect manner, which in some ways can make it more effective, I think.
Well, and I've quoted some of your epigrams, your bon mots on Twitter, and I can't remember any of them now, but you had one yesterday about economics, the definition of economics.
Oh, yes. Yes, so the definition, I say it's the art of telling you exactly what's going to happen and then explaining why it didn't.
Yeah. I mean, this might be another one for your poster. You're the Oscar Wilde of political satire.
Well, this is one hell of a poster you're giving me. This,
we are the New York Times of Reduced Shakespeare Company podcasts. That stuff is incredibly valuable. And so were you a classics major? Is that what you were?
I got a degree in classics. I mean, we don't use the term major over here.
That's right.
And to use it would be to really overstate my achievement, which I did not study quite as intensively as my tutors would have liked me to. But I love the subject, and it was fascinating, particularly studying this 2,500-year-old comedies that... I saw a production in Athens when I was on holiday there about 10 years ago, and it was in the ancient Roman theatre, it was just a couple of hundred yards away from where the ancient Greek theatre, where this would have originally been performed in sort of just before 400 BC.
Cool.
And it was performed in modern Greek to a modern Greek audience, and these jokes were getting laughs 2,400 years after they were written. And it was really quite inspiring. And I couldn't entirely understand what they were, because it was in modern Greek. And my ancient Greek is very rusty. But it was amazing to see. And a lot of the structures of the jokes that Aristophanes used, you still see all the time today. And, the political satire, it was kind of a mixture of political satire, literary parody, and dick jokes, and, you know, something for everyone.
So, a little something. Yeah. Something for they do love a phallus, the ancient Greeks.
You couldn't get enough of them.
Yeah. Did you know you were going to be a stand-up when you were studying this at college?
No. I wanted to be a sports journalist. So, and I do now write about cricket as a sideline that I got to via comedy. So, no, I didn't. I was always interested by comedy, but I didn't really think of it as a career, really, until after I'd started doing stand-up, and I just sort of did stand-up.
Well,
and
speaking of sports journalism, you achieved a kind of a sort of life goal, wasn't it, earlier this year?
So I just started doing, joined the BBC Radio Cricket commentary team, doing statistics and for the England cricket team in their one-day international matches. So it was something I'd wanted to do since childhood.
Well, I'm gonna give you an opportunity to have a go at an American, because, you know, my favorite part of cricket is the fact that it makes baseball look exciting.
And I quite like baseball, but I mean, cricket to me is the greatest achievement in the history of humanity, the greatest human creation. So you Americans, you really belatedly should get back on board.
Well, indeed, and I can think of the only thing more exciting than watching cricket is listening to it on the radio.
Well, it's great on radio. I don't know if you have radio baseball commentary, but
we do.
Games which have pauses in it gives the commentators a lot of scope to create pictures and go on tangents and, you know, really get into the what is going on in the game in some detail, and also what is not going on in the game in a lot of detail as well. So the cricket commentary has always been hugely popular.
Right. when I told my son that I was interviewing you today, he's a rising sophomore at Georgetown University, and he has told me he wants to go big or go home with the useless liberal arts degree, and is going to be a classics major. Do you have any advice for young Quincy as a classics major? sorry, as one who has a degree in classics?
No, I'm not sure you should be coming to me for careers advice. I spend most of my time sitting in a shed at home, looking up cricket statistics and writing puns. So,
well, perhaps you could be a cautionary tale then.
Yeah, a cautionary tale. But I don't know, I think classics is a great subject. It trains your brain and teaches you about history, language, philosophy, the works. So, yeah. The world is your oyster, Quincy, potentially, if you pay attention and work hard.
So what's next for the Bugle, now that Percy Primetime is a little busy?
Actually, yeah, TM, that's his official name now. It's returning in September with rotating guest co-hosts from around the world. So some from America, Hari Kondabolu and Wyatt Cenac will be doing it. Nish Kumar from Britain, and my sister Helen, who is the undisputed empress of podcasting, and Anuvab Pal, who's an Indian comedian, and hopefully a few more to be added to what I believe you call the rotation in
Indeed.
America.
Indeed. Will it include Rory Albanese's The American?
Well, yeah, I saw a thing from him on Twitter, volunteering his services, so hopefully that will hopefully that will happen at some point.
That was a great regular feature, and I love that you... I hope I didn't out him by...
I think he has been outed before.
Okay.
But...
I mean, I literally had to Google and went, who is this guy? And then, of course, he's been he's available again because of The Nightly Show being canceled. The other thing that my son told me is that he spent a great portion of this summer downloading and listening to past Bugles to keep a sense of irony and perspective with the American election coming up.
Yes, and it's been a bit unfortunate that we've been off air this year because there's been... a lot of stuff in a lot of places that would have been great to cover, but sadly we couldn't do it. And the American election will be fascinating. In fact, I'm touring the States, doing a few gigs there September and October. Well, it'll be on my website, which does actually have something on now after years of... I'm still waiting to see if the internet's going to catch on. I'm sceptical. But if you look at andyzaltzman.co.uk, there's a few US dates. So it'll be interesting being there. I'll be there. I don't think I'll be there long enough to see the actual election take place. But in the weeks building up to it, I'm expecting all manner of crazy mayhem.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. You can find out where Andy will be performing in the U.S. at his website, andyzaltzman.co.uk. Download new and archived episodes of The Bugle Podcast at thebuglepodcast.com, or follow them both on Twitter at HelloBuglers or at ZaltzCricket. Then send us your best politically satirical bon mot via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also engage with us and other fans on Facebook or Twitter. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Austin Titchener. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, senior domestic correspondent Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Sarah Agnew. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to the Big Bang Theory's Simon Helberg, who's currently amazing and hysterical alongside Meryl Streep and Hugh Grant in the movie Florence Foster Jenkins, which also features Reduced Shakespeare Company actor David Menken. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 509 1527ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
We are all we're all desperate for some of the Bugle's wisdom.
Yes, well, wisdom. Yeah, that's stretching the term wisdom slightly too far, but we'll be back.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.